B. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science, technology, and economics in the modern world.
A lot happens between 9 and noon.
The judge already knew that I was going to be charged as an adult.
The student loan issue is a huge issue.
The party is wrapped up and married to all of these social issues.
This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Carrie Miller along with Tom Weber. Investigative journalist Lawrence Wright is going to be with us about the Church of Scientology and his new book, Going Clear.
And Carrie, with another airline mega merger in the offer, American and U.S. Airways, what does it mean for flyers? We will ask that question. After a check of regional news, advocates on both sides of the gun debate will gather at the state capitol again this week when the Minnesota Senate holds a series of hearings on proposed legislation. Tim Pugmire reports.
The Senate Judiciary Committee hearings Thursday and Friday will look a lot like recent House hearings on similar bills. There are already Senate bills to toughen gun permit screening, prohibit unlicensed sales of some guns, and prevent more felons from owning guns. Other bills are designed to protect gun owners from changes in federal law. DFL Senator Ron Latz of St. Louis Park, the committee chairman, said he plans to proceed deliberately and carefully.
The tone I'm trying to set is not one of fanning the flames, but rather gathering information, being willing and open to consideration of all the proposals that come before us.
Latz said the committee won't vote this week on any of the gun bills. He said those decisions will come later in the session. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
A man charged with slapping a toddler on a Minneapolis to Atlanta flight is out of a job. AGC Aerospace and Defense says Joe Hunley of Hayden, Idaho, no longer works for the company. Hunley was charged with assault last week after he was accused of slapping a 2-year-old boy and calling him a racial slur during the February 8th flight. His attorney says he will plead not guilty. St. Paul police say a 5-year veteran officer who died over the weekend suffered a heart attack while on duty. Tim Nelson reports.
Police said that Josh Lino died Saturday from complications of a heart attack he suffered after a foot chase a week before. The department said Lino and his partner were on patrol on the city's east side after 10 p.m. on February 8th when they noticed a suspicious male who appeared to be hiding. They turned their car around and the suspect fled on foot. Lino and a police dog later found the suspect. He was identified as a teenager and issued a citation for curfew violation and fleeing. Lino became ill after the chase and was taken to Regents Hospital, where he was found to have suffered a heart attack. Lino was the son of another police officer, retired Sergeant Tim Lino. Details of Josh Lino's funeral services are still pending. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And authorities are investigating the death of an inmate who killed himself at the St. Louis County Jail in Hibbing. A news release from the sheriff's office says 30-year-old Shane Irvin Fisher of Duluth was booked early yesterday morning on suspicion of drunken driving, fleeing in a motor vehicle, and assault for trying to disarm a state trooper. His body was found about 5 hours later. The release says a preliminary investigation indicates Fisher tried suicide minutes after a required routine check on his well-being. And Carrie, that is the latest regional news here on the Daily Circuit.
Thank you, Tom. I got off a plane late last night that was crowded and a bit chaotic, but early into the gate. And so I'm grateful to Delta for that one. Still, we may all have to get used to more crowds and chaos and get used to tighter quarters on planes as yet another aviation mega merger is in the works. American and U.S. Airways are getting hitched. You've heard that. By now, you've heard what it means for the industry. What does it mean for flyers? Ben Mutzebaugh writes about aviation for USA Today, and he's with us today from Washington. Hi, Ben.
Good morning.
You said that the merger may be one of the biggest aviation stories of the year, if not the decade. Why?
You know, that's right. It's this kind of ends the round of consolidation that we've seen after regulation. And, you know, we've had 3 big mergers recently, 4 if you count Southwest AirTran. But mergers of these magnitudes are somewhat rare. And I think it's safe to say, you know, that in 2019, we're still going to be talking about the giant airline American and how they gained their current scale with a merger of U.S. Airways, or at least how that helped pave the road for them. So this is a big deal, and it has far-reaching implications, as you mentioned, both for the industry, but, you know, to your listeners, probably most importantly to them as well if they fly.
Yeah. I want to talk about fares first, and then we'll talk about flying experience. So logic would say that the fewer airlines in the marketplace, the less competition, the higher the fares. Is that the case?
Well, you know, that's what you would think, right? And I think that's what a lot of the conventional wisdom has been. That said, there has been one prominent study that came out following the United Continental merger, and it found that fares remained relatively flat after the Delta Northwest merger and after the United Continental merger. So, you know, of course, the economy had been in recession for a lot of that time, had just started to come out. So it's hard to say whether that was, you know, an effect of the economy or whether the competition had remained so robust that fares remained pretty constant. But
Yeah. So
far, we've not seen any big spike from airfares. And the logic that might be a bit counterintuitive is there is an argument to be made that by creating a third big global airline, Delta and United are the others, by putting American on a level playing field with those three, you create competition by having three big giant carriers instead of two big ones and then a bunch of smaller ones. And the argument being that two carriers can set the fares more easily when they dominate, but three creates makes it a little more difficult to kind of dictate the market. So, you know, who's right remains to be seen, but those are the two arguments.
You would think, though, that when you've got the three big ones all watching each other's fares really closely, that it's less likely, I guess, that one of them is really going to break out and introduce a fare war. I mean, is a lot of that now going to be left to the small fry that like to nip at the heels of the megas?
Well, that's definitely part of the strategy. And, of course, you know, the big three are still going to have to compete in the markets where none of them dominate. So they might dominate in hub cities like Minneapolis or in Chicago or in Dallas, but most markets in the U.S. are up for competition. So they are going to have to be price competitive. But I think to your point, that is what the real risk for these airlines are. If they get a little too greedy, for the lack of a better word, and set fares really high, that all but opens the door for a JetBlue, a Spirit,
right,
Frontier, Virgin America to come in and add new service and win business by undercutting the rivals. Yeah, I mean, Spirit is a great example. They might be the most no-frills carrier out there, and they offer the least amount of service. But
Right. We're
seeing them expand in markets where American has dominated and where other big airlines have dominated. So, you know, they've got to be careful about opening the door to competition as well.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that, though, because this is a hub, as you know, a Northwest became Delta hub here. And that assessment that the airlines, the scrappier ones, have to make to come in and try to compete with an airline like Delta has to be pretty darn thorough before they make a decision to come.
Right, that's right. And, you know, they do face a really big hurdle when they come into a market. You know, in Minneapolis, for example, even if Spirit is offering, or any airline, say even Virgin America, an airline that's known for its service, even if they come in and offer fares that are $50 or $60 less than what Delta's charging, how hard is it to get people to abandon their sky miles
right. That
they can use for a flight to Paris or to Tokyo
exactly. And
fly in Virgin America? That's a real challenge for these upstart carriers, but some of them seem to be making it work. You know, Spirit is there in Minneapolis, and they've really done a nice job of establishing themselves in Dallas recently.
Mm.
So there is opportunity, but it's very, very competitive.
Hey, if you're listening in to this conversation, we're talking with Ben Mutzebaugh from USA Today. I saw the news, as you did, of course, about the merger between American and U.S. Air, and we wondered, of course, what this means for the industry. But what does it really mean for the customers, those of us who are going to be flying on these mega airlines? And I'm asking you this morning as you listen, do you think it's going to change what you pay to fly, and do you think it's going to change your flying experience? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can go to the Daily Circuit page and click on the Hour Show to comment. Of course, you can tweet me at Carrie MPR. So, Ben, what about the crowds? I fly Delta a lot. It's a hub. And I have to say, I haven't been on a plane that wasn't crowded in years, I think. Are we going to see more of that?
Well, I think that's a trend that was going to continue regardless of the merger. But, yeah, that's just the new normal with flying anymore. And, you know, with looking back, we can say with hindsight now, these empty planes where you could pretty much count on a middle seat,
right,
that was a luxury of cheap oil that now that oil and by, you know, extending on down, jet fuel has become more expensive. Airlines just can't afford to operate so many empty flights or seats so that they have all these flights with empty seats. So they've just had to get more efficient and how full they can fly their flights to make a profit with fuel costing what it does these days. So I think that is here to stay. And yeah, U.S. Airways, American merger, they're going to overlap duplicative routes and flights, or eliminate duplicative routes and flights. So there will be some contraction there. And yeah, flights, if they don't get fuller, they certainly are not going to get less full because of the merger.
Let me grab a call here from Sarah in Minneapolis. Sarah, question?
Yes, I have a question about the new RNAV, the area navigation tracks that are supposed to be in place by 2025 nationwide. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they've been said that it's for safety and capacity, and also safety and fuel efficiency. And I'm curious if the capacity piece, if your guest thinks that they're going to be trying to be able to get more flights out, how are they going to, how's that going to work?
Ben, what do you know?
Going forward.
Well, you know, it's, I'm assuming that we're talking about the next gen here, that the government is trying to add for more efficient flight paths that,
yeah,
that would increase capacity. This is especially an issue in the Northeast, where you've got Washington, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, all so close together. That's where it's most obvious. And, you know, it's the track record is poor about this. The government talks about it all the time, and we see very little tangible results. I know that's shocking.
What a shock, yeah.
What happened in Washington
really
today. But, you know, I'm just, you know, I don't even know what to say about that right now, except to keep our fingers crossed and hope that it happens. But at some point, you know, air travel will go, as the population grows, air travel is going to go up everywhere. And, you know, at some point we're going to see the same congestion, whether it's in the Midwest or in the Southwest, that we see in the Northeast. And, you know, it's a big problem. The sooner we fix it, the more money airlines can save, the more money that we can put back into the economy. But, you know, this just has been one of those problems that we've just seen no headway with here in recent years, and I'm not optimistic we're going to see it in the next 18 either. But who knows? I hope they prove me wrong on that one.
You know, Ben, it's kind of interesting to go back to what we were talking about with the crowded planes. It's interesting to see how the airlines now are trying to tweak that customer experience, given the fact that you know, there's going to be more crowding. There's going to be more chaos as people get on and off planes. So what else can they do to try to affect the customer experience, given that?
Well, you know, they have turned it, and I'm not necessarily saying this as a bad thing, but, you know, I know fees is a bad word these days, but they have used this as an opportunity to upsell certain experiences as relating to flying that, for example, early boarding or, you know, enhanced economy seats that might give you 4 or 5 extra inches of leg room, and for anywhere from $5 to $50 on a flight, you might be able to get priority boarding or a better seat. So, you know, it's, I think as people get increasingly tired of the crush, it's a lot easier for the airlines to sell these things. That, you know, to your point, when you remember these days 10 years ago or so where we had the empty middle seat, would you have paid $10 to get on a plane early? Like, who would have done that? It wouldn't have made any sense. But now
right,
that the planes
yeah, oh, yeah.
are packed, this does give the airlines
right.
an opportunity not only to sell more seats, but to upsell passengers once they've bought the seat.
That's a good point. Well, and also those customer loyalty programs, they become ever more important, too. Right. Because you get the like the Sky Priority, you get to get on early. I know you were writing about Americans' loyalty program and how important that is and how good it is.
Yeah, you know, and that's true. And, you know, I've been a member of all of the three big frequent flyer alliances of the well, I am a member. I've been a lead in all of them over the past decade. I'm currently with SkyTeam, which is Delta's after many years of the Star Alliance. And,
right.
you know, regardless of what alliance you're on, I think to me that's one of the biggest values is making sure you fly at least the 25,000 miles a year, if not 50. So it's not so much that you get the bonus miles or any of that thing. It's so that you get priority check-in lines. So, you know,
exactly.
your call reservations calls don't go to a outsource center in India or someplace else where it's more difficult to make your reservations and to get the check bag fees waived. To me, that's the most important part of being elite, and that really does speak to the barrier, even that an airline like Virgin America, which is renowned for its service, but boy, they've got to work really hard to overcome the advantage that the Americans, the Deltas, the Uniteds have with their massive frequent flyer programs and all of the benefits that come with them.
I just got a tweet here that says Spirit's airfare to Florida next month is half the cost of American and Delta, but the flights are at 1 a.m. Convenience versus cost is the wave of the future.
Right. And, you know, and Spirit, of course, is the complete other end of the spectrum. We're just talking about all of these you know, amenities and perks that you get with these big airlines. Spirit's completely the opposite. That fare may be half price, but that is quite literally only getting you a seat on the plane. And I mean quite literally. If you want to bring a bag that doesn't fit in your seat, you're going to pay for it.
Jeez. To the phones to Linda in Rochester. Hi, Linda. What's your take on this?
Well, actually, it's really to contest sort of the universal consensus that people, especially in Minnesota, are extremely loyal to the SkyMiles program anymore. Just a few days ago, I've been gold platinum with Delta. I'm top with American, but was specifically with Delta. Just a few days ago, they announced a massive rehaul of their SkyMiles program in a punitive way.
They did? I wasn't even aware of that.
Yep, they did. The mileage levels for gaining elite status are going to be the same. However, to use miles, and they do this to some degree, depending on the kind of ticket that you get and where you want to go, et cetera, but you are going to have to pay significant amounts to be able to use your miles for any ticket, any upgrade, and they will no longer allow you to use miles on any code-share partner flight.
Jeez, Ben,
it's very punitive.
Have you been writing about this, Ben? I wasn't aware of that.
I think some of those details may not be completely on target there. They have, as all airlines do, they've announced some changes, and some are more friendly, some are less friendly. I certainly don't think they've eliminated the ability to use your miles on code-share flights. I could tell you for sure that the DOT would be on that awfully fast, because that would violate their agreement they have for antitrust immunity with these partner, with the joint venture partner airlines such as Air France and KLM. So
we should check it out. Some more details
but,
there.
What they have announced that I suspect might be at what we're talking about here is they've announced that starting in 2014 there'll be spending thresholds that. You can still earn miles, you can still redeem miles, but your elite status won't be attained unless you spend X number of dollars in a year. They're pretty low thresholds, but I think it is the beginning of a change where they go to more of a not necessarily a mileage-based program, but kind of a, you know, if you want to travel tomorrow, you're going to spend the equivalent miles of whatever the flight would cost for a last-minute fare. I think things are going to start to move toward that direction. But that's one of the things, you know, now where American is merging with U.S. Airways, and they're going to try to make their frequent flyer program competitive. It already is, but they're going to try to really use that as a tool to win customers from Delta, to win customers from United. So, you know, it's good. They might become more generous in the short term. Now, whether that sticks out over 3 or 4 years remains to be seen, but, you know, there is some increase in competition in that regard.
That would explain, Ben, all the emails I'm getting from American. I think it has already begun. Ben, a pleasure to talk with you, as always. Thanks so much for the insight.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Matzebar writes about aviation for USA Today. Book that flight now, Mr.
Wow.
Weber. I'm concerned that prices are going up. We'll see.
In other news this hour, Carrie, U.S. Senator Mike Johanns of Nebraska says he will not seek re-election in 2014. The Republican said in a statement this morning he has decided to, quote, close this chapter of his life. He's also a former Nebraska governor and U.S. Agriculture Secretary. Johanns joined the U.S. Senate in 2009. The owner of the NBA's Los Angeles Lakers, Jerry Buss, has died. Under his leadership since 1979, the Lakers put together a record rival by few teams in sports history. They reached the NBA Finals 16 times. An assistant says Buss died today at a Los Angeles hospital at the age of 80. The Somali government is offering a $50,000 reward for information that leads to the convictions of those killing journalists. That's according to the country's prime minister, who said today that the reward will help ensure that such killers are brought to justice. Somalia is one of the world's most dangerous countries in which to practice journalism. That's according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Last year, 18 Somali journalists were killed, but no arrests were made. So far this year, one reporter has been killed, bringing to 45 the total number of journalists killed in Somalia since 2007. Coming up at noon on NPR News Presents on this President's Day, we'll hear a Chautauqua lecture by historian Richard Norton Smith about the lives of presidents after they leave office. That's coming up after the Daily Circuit.
Programming is supported by our educational partner, Luther College, challenging students to think together about complex issues, ideas, and beliefs. You can learn more about Luther at luther.edu.
Call in with your comments. 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. This is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Carrie Miller, and now we're in depth on the Church of Scientology. I was deep into investigative journalist Lawrence Wright's book about Scientology when I remembered that the largest Scientology church in the Midwest sits but a stone's throw from our headquarters here at Minnesota Public Radio. When it opened in the fall of 2011, City Council member Dave Thune told the large audience that he'd read church founder L. Ron Hubbard's book, The Way to Happiness, so many times it was, quote, dog-eared. The St. Paul property is part of a real estate empire that includes millions of square feet around the world. And as Mr. Wright points out, many of those holdings are in Hollywood. Today, a conversation about what Lawrence Wright discovered in years of research about the church. You may recognize his name as the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, about Al-Qaeda. The new book is titled Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. And he joins us this morning from Austin, Texas. And Lawrence Wright, welcome. I'm really glad you could be with us for the conversation.
Well, thanks so much. I'm pleased to join you.
May I ask how the church has amassed the kind of money to buy and maintain all of this property that it owns around the world? Where's the money come from?
Well, there are several revenue streams. One is from the books and articles that the founder, L. Ron Hubbard, published. More than 1,000 books. He holds the Guinness Book of World Records for that. Then membership dues and, you know, contributions by members. These members are constantly asked for money, and it's made a tremendous success. The government, the church probably holds more than $1 billion in liquid assets, most of it in offshore accounts, according to my sources.
So is there, and I'm trying to remember what you wrote about this in the book, is there a tithing system, or is it that you are just expected to give when the church asks?
Well, there's no tithe, but in order to climb the pyramid of spiritual attainment in Scientology, it's very expensive. If you go all the way to the top, it can cost you more than $500,000. Then on top of that, there's the auditing, which is like Scientology therapy, and that is also very pricely. You're expected to do that routinely. And then on top of that, there's, you know, you have to join the International Association of Scientologists, which can be, an annual dues. And you're supposed to buy all the works that you're referred to of L. Ron Hubbard, and you'd need to buy an e-meter. It mounts up. I mean, it's a very expensive process and a very profitable one for the church.
We'll come back and we'll explain what the e-meters are and the auditing in just a minute. But I watched the video of when this building, when the church took over this building in downtown St. Paul. As I mentioned, it was in 2011. There were a lot of St. Paul dignitaries there and a huge crowd. Are communities often welcoming to the Church of Scientology? I mean, do they assess this as good economic development? What's the reaction when they want to buy one of these pieces of property?
Well, Scientology has bought some, you know, very historic properties all around the world. I mean, and in places like Times Square, DuPont Circle, Music Row, those are, you know, landmark locations. And that's part of their trademark, is to find a historic building and renovate it and make it, you know, really shine. And, of course, being a church, much of their property is off the tax rolls. So there's, like in Clearwater, Florida, where they maintain their spiritual headquarters, it comes at a real cost to the city. And in Hollywood, where they also have a number of properties, I think that the communities involved have very mixed reactions to having Scientology buy up so much property.
Yeah, in Hollywood, I think you report that they own $400 million or somewhere around there of property. How is it that L. Ron Hubbard and the church leaders realized that Hollywood would be fertile ground?
Well, that's where the Church of Scientology was established in 1954. Hubbard had an idea that celebrity was one way the church could get on the map, and the capital of celebrity in the whole world is Hollywood. Early in the church's history, there was a publication that included a list of desirable celebrities to be recruited into Scientology. And they included, you know, Bob Hope, Walt Disney, Marlene Dietrich, Howard Hughes, some of the most notable people in the whole world. And none of those people joined, but others did. I mean, Gloria Swanson, who was the silent movie star, Rock Hudson walked in the door for a while. You know, there were a number of celebrities that came through that were important personages. But the Scientology always was looking for that exemplary figure, the one that could take over. Hubbard had said his goal was to take over the entire entertainment industry. And so they were constantly recruiting young people who were going into acting or into music. Even to this day, for instance, there'll be people outside of central casting, which is where young actors go to get extra parts, and hand out brochures saying how to get ahead in the industry, how to get an agent. Come to the Celebrity Center, which is the Scientology building in Hollywood.
I mean, you can see why the church is recruiting among people with celebrity. You wonder, and I know you delved into this, what do the celebrities themselves believe that they're getting from the church?
Well, you know, if you look at some of the celebrities that are in the church, you know, for instance, Tom Cruise, John Travolta, Will Smith, who says he's not a Scientologist but has created a Scientology school for his children, each of these guys was the number one actor in the whole world. You know, that's very powerful. It makes a real impression on young wannabe actors about what Scientology might do for you. And constantly you have such personages like Travolta saying, it was Scientology that put me in the big time. He gives Scientology the credit for his career. And I think that has a real impression on young people who want to emulate that. There was a thought that Scientology had a network that would help you, you know, lead you to stardom. That's not really the case. But, you know, that was part of the impression that having Scientology celebrities sell the church, they sought to make.
I mean, it's been a very effective method, hasn't it?
Well, I think it was up until a certain point. Now I think that there's so much stigma associated with being involved in the church that the celebrities themselves are trying to keep a certain distance. I think you don't see new celebrities going into the church, you know, big names. There's no new Tom Cruise, for instance, that has joined the church. There may be someday. But and there may be people of, you know, I'm constantly hearing about secret Scientologists, for instance, people who are Scientologists but don't want to let that be known for public relations reasons.
Lawrence Wright's with us if you've just tuned in. He's an investigative journalist. He's the author of The Looming Tower. And he has spent years and gathered many, many sources and documents to investigate the Church of Scientology. The book is called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. If you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, we have a statement from the church itself, although I should say that Lawrence Wright also spoke with former members of the church and tried repeatedly to get into detail with current members of the church. But I received an email over the weekend with the awareness that Lawrence Wright was going to be on the show, and they forwarded another statement here specifically responding to what Lawrence Wright's book says. You can find a link to that on the website. You can check that out. Now, if you're a member of the Church of Scientology and you'd like to call in and talk to us about your own experience, I'd be very welcoming to hear that. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. If you just have questions about the Church of Scientology, you've seen the buildings, you're aware of the interest in your own community, this is an opportunity to call in and ask your question. Go to the Daily Circuit page, click on the Hour Show to comment, and you can also reach me on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Lawrence, I want to talk about Tom Cruise here because you spend some time talking about his influence and how on the church and how he was influenced by the church. And I want to play an excerpt from a video that was released in 2008. He's talking about his commitment to Scientology and what it has meant to him to be a Scientologist. Let's listen.
Being a Scientologist, when you drive past an accident, it's not like anyone else. as you drive past, you know you have to do something about it because you know you're the only one that can really help. But that's what drives me, is that I know that we have an opportunity and to really help for the first time effectively change people's lives, and I am dedicated to that. I'm absolutely, uncompromisingly dedicated to that.
Will you interpret what he means there, if you can?
Sure. In Scientology, they believe that at certain levels, higher levels of spiritual attainment, you have healing powers. And every Scientologist has talked about such things as called a contact assist. It's like a laying on of hands, where if you bump your head on a door, for instance, the Scientology practice would be to put your head repeatedly against the part of the door that you bumped until it's drained of any sensation. You don't feel the pain. But actually, L. Ron Hubbard talked about being able to raise the dead, and I'm not saying that that's what that Tom Cruise was saying in that, but Scientologists do believe that they have additional healing powers others don't have. And so when he drives by an accident, and supposedly if he sees someone who's injured, he can do something about it that other people can't. I actually talked to Josh Brolin, said that he once witnessed John Travolta healing Marlon Brando, who had injured himself helping a motorist who had gone off the Pacific Coast Highway. He had cut his leg and had come to a dinner party. And so Travolta said that, he had just gotten up to a new level in Scientology, and he felt that he could help him. So Brando said, sure, and Travolta put his hand on Brando's leg, and according to Brolin, it was, quite a physical sensation just watching. And Brando said he felt better. So that's the paradigm in Scientology.
And if it was mind over matter? Well, it worked, at least in that situation.
Yes,
right?
Indeed. I mean, it may have been a palliative. It certainly made an impression on Brando and Travolta, or maybe he was being nice about it. But, Travolta certainly believed that he had the power to make Brando heal.
To the phones to Will in Moorhead. Hi, Will, your question.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask of your guest there if he could talk a little bit or offer any information about, I've heard, and I think there's actually even like documented proof that Scientology, they combat or they stringently oppose psychiatry, psychology. And, I know I've seen like news releases and press clippings here and there every now and then over the years. I was just wondering if, your commentator could comment on that. And wonderful show today. Thank you.
Thanks. Are they anti-psychiatry, Lawrence?
Bitterly. And this goes back to L. Ron Hubbard's publication of a book called Dianetics in 1950. It's a kind of self-help therapy manual that swept the country and others, but especially in the United States. It dominated the New York Times bestseller list for weeks and weeks. It was a sensation. There were Dianetics clubs starting up and so on. And before publication, Hubbard had sent the manuscript to the American Psychological and American Psychiatric Associations with the idea that they would put their stamp of approval on it. And they looked at it in absolute puzzlement because to them it was just psychological folk art. It made no sense at all. And Hubbard never forgot this slight. And after that, he developed the theory that psychiatrists were the root of all problems in humanity. Racism, plague, genocide, terrorism, everything you can imagine that is a problem plaguing humanity goes back to evil psychiatrists who are trying to take over the world.
It's an interesting intersection in a town like Hollywood, where I think therapists do a pretty thriving business,
yes,
don't they? To the phones to Robert in Minneapolis. Hi, Robert.
Hello there.
Hi.
Just Just a question. With most churches, you can come to the table without money. They'll hand you the literature. You can be a part of the congregation. I was just wondering, is money the key factor here with people joining the church, or is anybody able to join?
Well, anyone is able to join. I mean, by joining, we mean walking in the door and, you know, or maybe even just taking a test. What Scientology counts as membership is practically anybody who's ever taken any interest in the religion at all. But if you want to take courses, you're going to pay for them. And if you want auditing, you're going to pay for them. And it mounts up really quickly. The deeper you get in, the more expensive it is. It's unusual in that way. But, you know, certainly there are many other religions that ask for money, and they obtain it in different ways. But Scientology has, an unusual focus, I would say, on getting money out of its members.
Lawrence Wright is with us. If you've tuned in, he's the author of Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. The church has issued a statement specifically about Mr. Wright's book, and you can find a link to that on the Daily Circuit page. If you have questions about Scientology, or you're a member of the church and you'd like to call up and talk to us about your own experience with the church, 800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. You can reach me on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Hey, I'm interested, as you've been doing quite a few interviews about this and traveling with it. Do you hear from very many just average members of the church? I know the leadership is not very happy with you, but what about average members of the church?
Gary, none of them have.
Really?
Yeah, it's to me, and of course, many of the shows that I've been on, they've asked representatives of the church to come on, and they never have. They typically do what they did with you, is to send a statement denouncing me.
Yeah, when I emailed back to say, please join us, and there was no response. So.
Right. I think that tells you something. I'm here. I have been engaged in some email correspondence with members of the church, but and I've offered them free copies of my book. They're criticizing me without actually having read it. And it all speaks to me of this kind of totalistic mindset that becomes so characteristic of Scientology. The members are instructed not to look at things that are critical of the church, and it seems that very few of them do. So I don't expect that my book will be widely read by active members of the church, because their church tells them that it's going to be bad for their spiritual health.
Yeah, I guess just an opportunity. I am surprised that just average members of the church wouldn't engage in a discussion with you, you know, in forums like this.
Right.
But I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Steph from the Daily Circuit page?
Yeah, we've got two comments there about whether it's a cult or not. Someone says, Scientology seems very obviously to be a cult, and yet it enjoys the benefits of being a church, talking about tax exemption. Mm-hmm. And someone else wrote, I hate to tell you this, but under the freedom of religion, we all have the choice to choose what church we want to attend. I just saw a documentary about how families have been torn apart because other family members wanted to leave the Church of Scientology. I may not agree with that, but as Americans, they still have the right to choose which church one wants to attend.
And you are certainly not denying that, Lawrence.
No,
Wright,
not at all.
Right?
In fact, I don't use the word cult.
Why not, though?
Well, because I don't think both the term religion and the term cult are very capacious, and they can mean pretty much what you want them to mean. The only opinion that really matters in this is that of the IRS, an organization very ill-equipped to make such distinctions. But in 1993, the IRS decided that Scientology was a religious community. It did this in the face of 24 300 lawsuits that Scientology had launched against the IRS and individual agents and investigators, private investigators hired to track, you know, follow IRS agents in at like conventions to see who was drinking too much and who was fooling around on the road. And, you know, this is all, I don't know exactly what criteria the IRS applies to making that distinction, but part of the deal in 1993 was that those lawsuits would be dropped and the investigators called off. And in response, the church, which at that moment owed $1 billion in back taxes, that was dropped to $12 million. If it had not gotten that exemption in 1993, there would be no Scientology today.
On Twitter, a listener says, "My experience with Scientology has been good. I've never been forced to buy anything, particularly not an e-meter." Let's explain the genesis of the e-meters, which started out with, if I remember this right, Campbell soup cans.
That's
Is
correct,
that right?
With the labels scraped off. It's one-third of a lie detector, essentially. There's two wires that go to these cans that you hold, and they're connected to a meter. And an auditor, in Scientology terms, examines the needle to see, if you're having an emotional reaction, if you're misleading, or, you know, this actually does measure something. And in terms of Scientology, it's thought to measure thoughts that are just below the level of consciousness. And if you believe that, it can be very, very powerful tool. And oftentimes in Scientology's auditing sessions, people have memories of past lives, for instance, and the e-meter validates those memories. So that comes as very good news to most people, that the idea that they've lived before and therefore will live again is one of the principal tenets of Scientology, and the e-meter is used to demonstrate that. I'll just say that, you know, people buy their e-meters at higher levels of Scientology's spiritual pyramid when they're expected to audit themselves. So the tweeter, in that case, may not have gotten to that stage yet.
Okay. And auditing is what, for simplicity's sake, it's kind of the examination of your own belief system within Scientology?
Well, it is a form of therapy, and it's more than that. It's different from that, I would say. And what can happen if you were to go into that St. Paul Church and take auditing, and you would you might have be sitting there looking at your auditor, and he would be examining the needle, and he'd suddenly say, "What was that?" And you would say, "What? You know, do you had a thought there?" And, well, I just had an image of, let's say, a farmhouse. Well, go back to that. Go back and take a look at that farmhouse. And now open the door and walk outside and look and see what's there. Well, it looks like England in the 1700s or something like that. Well, eventually you're coaxed into having this memory of a previous existence. And that can, you know, because the e-meter is telling you it's true, it has a lot more force than something that might be confabulated some other way.
On Twitter, I was in a Scientology drug rehab center in Oklahoma for 3 months. It was one of the strangest experiences of my life. To the phones to Barbara in Minneapolis. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
Our daughter is a Scientologist. She's been in Scientology a number of years. And we have been very curious about it, but it's been hard to get to know her religion because you can't dabble in it very easily. I've taken a couple of courses, and I'm hounded. They're very nice, but they call me a lot to take the next course. And anyway, our experience has been a struggle through all these years. It was very hard in the beginning. but she seems very happy now, and it is her religion. And she works at the church as well as her full-time job, and that's her life.
And so has she tried to bring you into this, Barbara, hoping that you would understand more about it? Or?
Well, part of it is I would like to understand more about it. and she's happy with that, and I went with her. I've been to the Celebrity Center in L.A. Mm. It's a beautiful place. We even stayed there when she was working at the Celebrity Center, and they were very, very courteous and very wonderful to us. It was the best suite we've ever stayed in, and I took a course there, but I always felt like an outsider, and like maybe if I had gotten, I don't know, I always felt like an outsider when I was there. I can't explain it.
Thanks so much for the call, Barbara. Lawrence, is that part of the power of how Scientology works, that once you're enveloped by this belief system that is powerful in many different parts of your life?
I would describe it as a totalistic religion. It has answers for every possible question. And I would want to say, too, about Barbara's situation, families in which one member is a member of Scientology and other parts of the family are not, they tread a difficult line, because if she were to oppose her daughter's membership in Scientology, then it's possible, it's even likely, that the church would declare her a suppressive person and her daughter would be asked not to have any more communication with her. I've met many, many families that have been torn apart in that fashion. And so it's, you know, she's in a volatile spot right now with her daughter, because if she were to come to the conclusion that her daughter was being harmed by Scientology or bilked or anything, you know, like that, then there would be a real tug of war over the loyalty of her daughter.
To Natalie in Excelsior. Hi, Natalie.
Hi.
What's your experience been with this?
I grew up in Scientology and was in it for 35 years, and my family left just a couple of years ago. And we were lucky enough to keep our family intact. Three generations of us left at the same time. The thing when you grow up in the church, or even when you're around it for a long time, you don't recognize the indoctrination as indoctrination or as brainwashing. And that's part of why I think they try to keep you isolated. You, most of you, you're going to hang out with Scientologists. You tend to pull away from your family that are not Scientologists. And if anything's going on in Scientology, I'll give you a great example. My daughter worked for the church that's now in St. Paul, and she was sent to Florida to do some training. And we got her back and found out that, and she never told us that while she was there, when she didn't make certain sales quotas, she was forced to eat beans and rice instead of regular food along with other people, and was made to stay up till 2-3 o'clock in the morning cleaning bathrooms and not getting enough sleep as punishment for not making sales quotas. She never told us. So if you have a family member in Scientology, especially someone who works for them, they're not going to tell you, more than likely, the things that really go on there.
Lawrence, is that what you've found as you've talked to people that have been in the church?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, especially the very aggressive sales techniques and the punishment of people that, you know, they're not allowed to go to sleep unless they meet quotas. And sometimes that results in fraud. And people are so desperate to, you know, sell the books or whatever that they hack into members' accounts. And, you know, oftentimes members will have money on account, for instance, for future courses, and they'll drain that. It's especially a problem with the clergy in Scientology, which is called the Sea Org or Sea Organization. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you know, people oftentimes join as children. They're recruited at alarmingly young ages, and they sign a contract for 1 billion years of service with the idea that, you know, life goes on lifetime after lifetime, and this one lifetime is just a speck in the span of universe, and you'll be living all that time. But they're impoverished. They give up their educations, and they're made to work really, really long hours, And if they decide to leave, it's very difficult for them. Oftentimes, they don't have family members outside of the church or friends. They may be in one of these Scientology compounds, like the one in Southern California, in the desert, where their contact with the outside world is really minimal. It's just very, very difficult for them to actually leave the church.
You know, the statement that the church sent and that we've got a link to on the website is harsh about you. I mean, it uses words like corrupt. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, in reading the book, I really appreciated and I have to say admired your sense of openness and objectivity when you were learning things about the church and the beliefs and L. Ron Hubbard and his successor that sounded so impossible to believe. I didn't sense that you were making a judgment as you were doing your investigation. So tell me what you think of that.
Well, thank you for saying that. First of all, I didn't set out to write an expose of Scientology. Why would I do that? It's the most stigmatized religion in America. I was curious, like most people, you know, about why people joined the Church of Scientology and why notable people like Tom Cruise and others lend their credibility to that organization. It doesn't seem to me, at least now, that they gain, you know, anything from it, except they suffer a tremendous public relations martyrdom for their beliefs. So they must feel some powerful allegiance to it. And I wanted to get in and find out what drew them into this. I've always been curious about religious beliefs, not just Scientology. I've written about a number of different religions. But Scientology is unusual. It's very esoteric. A particular community that is far more notable than its actual number of members. And all those things called me as a curious person. And that seemed, you know, an ideal place for an investigative reporter to go in and take a look.
Did you believe, as you began, that there might be ways to cooperate with the church, or at least that there might be church leaders who would sit down for interviews and be willing to be challenged, you know, and also to educate you about the church?
Well, originally, that was the deal. I was told by Tommy Davis, who was at that time the international spokesperson for the church.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing about Paul Haggis, who had dropped out of, he's an Academy Award-winning director, who dropped out of the church. And Tommy wasn't happy about that. But he said he would take me through Scientology. And so on Memorial Day, in 2010. He wanted to have enough time, so I went out for the long weekend and spent 2 days cooling my heels in the hotel waiting for him. And finally he came and said that he wasn't going to take me through Scientology. He just wanted to have the opportunity to tell me person to person. It was, thanks a lot. I mean, at great expense to the New Yorker, you know, I've been sitting out here waiting for this. All future questions were channeled strictly through the spokesperson's office. All my requests to talk to executives were rejected. Of course, the leader of the church, David Miscavige, hasn't given an interview in more than 20 years. So I didn't really expect that he would talk to me, but I wanted to have the opportunity to talk to any high-level executives that I could speak to, but that was rejected.
What's the question if they were to say, all right, you've got an hour with David Miscavige? What's the key question you'd want to know now that you've completed the investigation?
Oh, there's so many allegations swirling around that particular individual. I had 12 people tell me they'd been beaten by David Miscavige,
mm-hmm.
and they had been in a high-level organization, you know, high-level executive positions in the church. I had 20 people who said that they've witnessed such actions. I think that, you know, with that much, that many witnesses, that many people who've experienced that, he should respond to those allegations. You know, there are a lot of other historical details. I would love to have had the opportunity to talk to him about his own entry into the church and his relationship with the founder and his the way he took over the church. He was not the designated heir to Scientology. But at the age of 25, after Hubbard died, he pushed away his contenders and grabbed the helm. I would love to have his perspective on how that all came about. I mean, there are a ton of questions I can imagine sitting down and talking to him about, but I was never afforded that opportunity.
Well, I have to say, we've just scratched the surface. What an amazing read, and thank you so much for the time today.
It was a pleasure.
I've been grateful to be able to talk with you. The book is called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. It's featured on the Daily Circuit book page, and well worth a read. Really interesting. This is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Programming is supported by UCARE, the homegrown health plan designed to make Medicare simple. Information on the new Medicare for you or a loved one at ucare.org. UCARE, healthcare that starts with you. Programming is supported by Minnesota Parent Magazine's Camp Fair, Saturday, February 23rd at the Como Zoo from 10 until 2, featuring a variety of quality camps for quality kids. mmparent.com, sponsored by Minnesota College Savings Plan.
Support comes from CenterPoint Energy, working to support businesses with high-efficiency natural gas equipment programs and services that can help lower operating costs, decrease energy use, and help the environment. CenterPointEnergy.com/businessrebate.